Okay, just for those of you that arrived late, we're going to do a geodynamics tutorial today. In fact, we're going to do two combined, one and two, which were online. One is convection in a coffee cup, and the other is going to be using sitcom, a three-dimensional sitcom. And you can download them from the CIDR website if you didn't get a copy. Whoops. And this is what the tutorials look like. These were written by Bruce. Credit where credit is due. Okay. So let's start. This lecture should be a bit shorter than the other lectures that we've had so far. Okay, it's just meant to be an overview of how to solve geodynamic problems. Before I get into that, I wanted to just remind you of the geodynamics outline, which we haven't shown before, and of the lectures that we have. And as Bruce mentioned in his first lecture, really geodynamics is about the thermal evolution of the planet, and of course there's the chemistry, but it all goes into the thermal evolution of the planet. And he covered the geotherm, and then he covered what's most important for us, what are the governing equations for fluid flow in the mantle, and some approximate solutions in terms also of this thermal evolution, the Rayleigh-Nussel, which you'll be doing in the tutorial, and which we'll come back again. And what we'll do next is the following. Is given the fact that he's derived equations, the governing equations, the conservation of mass, momentum, and energy, we're going to look at how geodynamics approaches solving those equations. Those equations are nonlinear, they're partial differential equations, hence they have no exact solutions except in a few very special cases. And so today is really going to be an overview of the different methods that we have of solving the problem. And these are numerical, full-blown numerical simulations, analytical models, which are approximate solutions to these equations, including thermal evolution models, although I'm not going to show any today, but Bruce will show in the last lecture, and also some experimental work and show you why it is important to do experimental work. And then I think in the context of the workshop that we have going on right now, which is the generation of chemical and thermal heterogeneity, or heterogeneity in general in the mantle and its relation to seismic structure, what I'm going to cover next is what perhaps we think of as two scales of flow in the mantle, plate and subduction, that's supposed to be slabs, and plumes, hotspots, and I'm not going to cover transitions, almost likely, and the core mantle boundary. Okay, and in both cases, I'm going to try to give you a flavor of what's going on right now in terms of the research, but also of how they generate heterogeneity. And my last lecture is going to be on geological constraints, which is what most of my geodynamics career, as short as it is, has been about, is trying to incorporate geological constraints in a very broad sense into geodynamical models. Okay, so these are the governing equations as Bruce showed them last time, as he derived them actually last time. And these are in indition notation now. And I want to, you know, these are full-blown, these are wide, I can't even reach up there. Particularly what I want to draw your attention to is that in the terms here, this is slightly different than he had it. That's the viscosity, and I've written it there as a tensor, as a fourth-rank tensor, which is supposed to be, although we usually use it as just a scalar. And the reason I have it like that, it's this probably is a tensor, and its tensorial properties are likely very important for generating plates from mantle convection. And that's something, it's an active area of research. Now, the problem that we're concerned with, and one that Barbara alluded to in her introductory remarks, is that mantle dynamics wants to understand also what's going on at the surface, and in particular plate tectonics. And it's very, very hard to make a fluid behave like plates. And in particular, even for behavior inside the mantle, we just don't know what the right constitutive relation is, you know, how to relate stress to strain rate. And, you know, in the case of faulting, you know, how to relate stress to strain as well. Now, in fluid dynamics, we're saved by the fact that we can do scaling and we can do lots of things. We don't have to have exact reproductions of models. For brittle failure, that's another problem. Now, the constitutive relation, although I only have viscosity right there, it's not just viscous, it's viscoelastic and is also important for plates, particularly for deformation, and particularly for people like me that worry about the lithosphere and its connection to mantle dynamics. And one of the problems, as alluded to, in terms of faults and generating brittle failure is faults. And the problem is that faults have well, are long lived, and it's also a problem for treating them in fluids. And so basically we have a very large range of time scales and length scales that we have to worry about in terms of the dynamics. And these are not time scales and length scales that are always compatible. Okay. So what approaches can we take? Well, the one that you know, many people use in geodynamics, although you might it's used by different set of people that do numerical models, is what I've called observational modeling. That's not a really good term for it, but it's the only one I could come up with. And that is one in which you might approximate the solution to the equations, but you're trying to reproduce observations. Another way to put it is we're trying to understand the Earth as it is today, and not just the fundamental physics of an Earth or an Earth-like planet. And I'll get back to that. And both approaches are important. The other is an approach that we can call theoretical, because it's solutions to the equations, numerical solutions to the equations, or analytical solutions for that matter. And one that it's mostly exemplified by numerical simulations of the Navier-Stokes. And finally, a field that has thankfully gotten a lot of recharge energy for mental dynamics is a lot of experimental work in trying to simulate the structure of flow in the mantle experimentally, and that is using fluids that might reproduce the behavior of flow in the mantle. Yes?
This may be not everything ever like this, but is that actually showing the slab that's going down?
This right here? Okay, this is a calculation in axisymmetric cylindrical geometry by Shiji Zhang and Mike Ernest. And these calculations in particular, yes, they were looking at a downwelling, how to generate a slab. And the innovation in that is that, one, they had a fault. They have a way to simulate a weak zone that was very similar to a fault. And I'll get into this. So they're able to generate an asymmetric downwelling. That's a characteristic of subduction that is very hard to simulate in fluid dynamics. And yes, it's supposed to be a slab going down. The other thing they looked at here is the rate of trench rollback and how that influenced whether the slab is going to pond at a 660-kilometer discontinuity or not. Although that, of course, is dependent on what parameters you assume for the thermodynamics of that phase transition. Okay, the top figure is the geoid anomalies of the Earth. This is an observation of the gravitational field. The bottom is the experiments that I did a long time ago. Okay, so then what are the problems that we're trying to understand in mental geodynamics? I mean, there are many of them, and this is not an extensive list. It's just something I put together thinking that it's issues that we can talk about during the workshop here. So I've divided it into two parts, understanding Earth and Earth-like planets. And what I meant by that is trying to make a division between trying to understand the fundamental physics of what's going on in terms of mental convection and fluid dynamics, and another one that I've called understanding Earth history, and that is trying to understand the Earth's day and how the Earth evolved to that state in terms of the actual geological events that happen. This is mostly what I do. And in this case, you can try to understand the gravitational field of the Earth, variations, how plates are driven, particularly today, without having to generate themselves consistently with the mantle convection, or the deformation of the surface, both in terms of what you might see in terms of seismic anisotropy, texturing of the mantle, and what you might see in the lithospheric stress field. And history, well, there are lots of things that you might understand. Thermal evolutions, perhaps ones I should have put up here, but the history of plate motions and how the driving forces might have changed. Another issue that is very hard to deal with, why do plates change direction, the history of tuple or wonder, and also, well, the information that we get from geochemistry, isotopic variability, and the time evolution of that isotopic variability. In terms of the fundamental physics, there are some very basic issues, some which I've already mentioned, and Bruce already mentioned as well, and others. What is the sources of energy driving the system? Now, we know that the planet has radioactive elements. We think we know that, right? And so a lot of the heat that drives mantle convection is internal heat, versus the heat that comes from the core, the inner core freezing, so primordial heat, which we call basal heating. Now, this becomes important because the structure of the flow, as you saw from Bruce's derivation of the thermal or boundary layers, or sketches of the thermal boundary layers, are radically different because the boundary layers are different, whether you have primarily internally heated or a primarily basally heated system. So the conventional wisdom is about an 80-20 division. 80% internal heat, 20% basal heat, and a lot of the estimates of the basal heat, well, some of them must come from the geodynamo, but some of them also come from trying to estimate things like plume flux, you know, through hot spots. And that perhaps is a little bit of a harder thing to do. Maybe. Okay, the constitutive law, which I've mentioned, scales of flow, plates we know are large, are the scales, are length scales of flow in the mantle very large, and hence of thermal heterogeneity. Plumes, which are smaller scale, do plates tend to organize the flow? Do they tend to suppress smaller scales? Those are issues that we'll be investigating particularly tomorrow. And then the stuff that has come out, and that's very important, is that all the constitutive relation, all the things that go into solving the material properties that go into the Navier-Stokes conservation of mass, momentum, and energy have to come from mineral physics, which is going to be the thermodynamics of the materials that make up the Earth. And I've translated this into here, and it's not the only thing, obviously, is phase transitions and their effect, in particular the fact that there's a lot more than olivine making the mantle, and hence a lot more phase transitions. And this translates into the structure of the flow, and that you can have layering and what happens to slabs as they go down. But another issue that will come up, well, I hope to bring up, is the fact that there's no thermodynamically consistent models out there in terms of how they're implemented in the fluid dynamical models. What I mean by that, people will have an effective alpha, is an effective thermal expansion or buoyancy parameter to do the phase transitions, but they will not take into account the fact that going, say, from going to perovskite, that means that the properties of the materials are radically different. Different thermal expansion, different things like that. I think Joe Light and Scott King did something like this a while back. Okay, and then what we're concerned with here is how to generate heterogeneity, what scales, and that has to do with the scales of the flow, the nature of the heterogeneity. Thermal, it's a given. There has to be thermal heterogeneity. The question is, of the heterogeneity that you observe, how much of it is not thermal? How much is due to phase transitions? How much is due to chemistry? And the origin of that heterogeneity. And then the destruction of that heterogeneity, and this is one of the problems that mantle dynamicists have worried about for a long time, and you know, from way back, I mean, Frank Richter did some stuff, and then also there's a seminal paper by Hoffman and McKenzie, and today there's a lot of work on this in trying to reproduce isotopic heterogeneity, the observed isotopic heterogeneity in the mantle. But I think we're a ways away from really understanding that, I hope to show you why. Okay, so that took a lot longer than I expected. Okay, now, why do we expect a mantle convection to have anything to do with plates? We are fond of saying, and with heterogeneity, we're fond of saying that mantle convection is a surface, plate tectonics is the main surface expression of mantle convection. And for a long time, and I think Don alluded to this, you know, people thought, oh, well, you know, there's upwelling below ridges, and this picture shows that. And at subduction zone, there's downwellings, and there's a simple picture. This is not the picture of mantle convection that emerges, because it's a vigorously convecting system. And although you won't be doing anything quite at that range, you will see that then the system is very time dependent, and it cannot possibly look like this. Now, but in any case, you know, you're going to do melting in ridges, you're going to cool the material, that material is going to subduct back into the mantle, it's gravitationally unstable, it's going to go back into the mantle, and therefore it is an expression of the motions, and also the plates are the top thermal boundary layer of the convecting system. Or as Dave Berkovici is fond of saying, plates are mantle convection. This is absolutely true. But there's another fact of introducing slabs into the mantle, that top thermal boundary layer that keeps going down, probably the most important if the Earth is primarily internally heated, and that is that as the slabs go down, and this is a tomographic picture from Doug Green's group, and so here's the blues and here are the reds, you're introducing continuously not just thermal heterogeneity because you've cooled the mantle, but you're also doing a lot of chemistry by dehydration and perhaps volatile fluxing and generating arc magmas. So you're doing all sorts of things. So there's constant generation of chemical heterogeneity at subduction zones. And then how that chemical heterogeneity might be recycled back into the mantle and what's going on, that's an issue that we need to investigate further. Okay, now, how do we know, in fact, that mantle convection, as it is in the mantle, gives you plate-like velocities? I just show this paper. These results are not going to go into any detail because it's a seminal paper for us. It's a paper by Don Turcotte in Oxford in 1967. And in this paper, they took the Navier-Stokes equation and they did something. They did some approximations. They solved it analytically with string functions. But basically, there are two things that they show that are very important. One, which is the top diagram, is that you get a constant horizontal velocity, except that the corners of their very simple isothermal cells that are moving around and thin boundary layers, but then they also characterize the Nusselt number as a function of distance away from a spreading center, and the solid line right here is their prediction, and the dots right here are measurements of the heat flow as they were at the time. And I think this is spectacular, and although we've moved a ways away from this, I think that that's an insight that has stayed with us and that has driven the field to try to understand that better. And so that's in terms of the scales of plates and the scales of flow of plates. The other scale, which is plumes, I think some of the seminal work is experimental rather than theoretical, and particularly by Jack Whitehead. And this is a paper that, unlike a lot of fluid dynamics in the mantle, it's actually quoted all over the fluid dynamics literature. So this paper by Whitehead and Luther, what they showed is this is a fluid, a thin fluid of different viscosity going into another fluid. Varying viscosity. And what you can see from this is, and this is not a great reproduction, this is scanned, but if you compare these two pictures right here, this is a fluid rising through another fluid of similar viscosity, and here the viscosity is much higher than that of the fluid being injected. And you see that the behavior of the head is radically different, so that you have, sort of this sort of spherical blob at a very thin conduit, and in this case, you actually have more like a mushroom head with a lot of stirring going on in the sides. Okay. So, ways in which we can solve geodynamic problems: numerical, theoretical, analytical, and experimental. So, how to construct a numerical model? Okay, well, these are numerical methods for partial differential equations. You can use spectral methods, does exist. Some of the first codes were spectral, so using spherical harmonics or something like that. Finite elements, which is what the sitcom is based on, very popular. There are new methods called spectral elements, which try to combine the power of spectral techniques and finite element techniques. Those haven't yet been applied. There's no code that I know of that uses spectral elements. Now, I take it back. There's at least one code by Paul Tackley. Any case, what are the characteristics that you need to have? It needs to be flexible, and by that I mean that it has to be able to do geometries that are, you know, such as the sphere, but also be able to, say, do plate boundaries. At least today, we think of that as very important. An adaptive resolution, like for subduction zones. Another thing that is very important, and you'll see this in the write-up of sitcom, is that they have to be methods and they have a way to solve them where you can handle very large material property contrast. What that means is that we expect in the Earth to be large variations in viscosity, certainly as you approach the plate interface, that's going to be true. And large property contrasts are very hard to handle numerically in terms of convergence and accuracy. So you have to have methods that do that properly and solvers for the different parts of the equations that do that properly. And then, you know, you need speed. You know, you want to be able to resolve those boundary layers, which are quite thin. You want to be able to resolve the structure, and you want to do so in an amount of time that is not your entire career. So, speed. So I thought I would put here a picture, since we live in this warp reality here at the Kavli Institute, where Macs are the only computers, that I would show the Virginia Tech supercomputer made of Macs, which, you know, one of the few in the world. Anyway, I just think it's strange. But, okay. So, now the other thing is that these days we are able to do global calculations, that means three-dimensional spherical calculations, but we're also interested in doing regional calculations and doing so properly. So what do we have to worry about with that? And actually, one of the members of the audience, Tan, he worries about this. And that is, if you do a regional model, say of a subduction zone, and you're extracting a piece of the mantle, what are the proper boundary conditions to put on the side? you know, because they are going to have an influence. You have to have, again, resolution and speed are issues. And then it depends on the nature of the problem, whether you pick a global or a regional model. So if you're studying subduction zones and you want to study a particular aspect of them, well, it's much easier to do it in a regional sense. Or if you're studying a ridge or you're trying to introduce melting together with the flow, it's much easier to use a regional code than a global code. Okay. What are the inputs that have to go in? Material properties. These are going to come from mineral physics, thermal expansion, thermal diffusivity, density, hopefully as a function of pressure, temperature, and composition. And then rheology, and this is probably the hardest thing. Well, they're all hard, but this is very hard. And this is going to be a function of pressure, temperature, composition, stress, and strain rate. Okay, so strain rate weakening, that's going to give you maybe a good weak plate boundary, a good plate boundary or not. Now, okay, why is this hard? I mean, they're all hard, of course. You know, you need the good experimental work in mineral physics or good theory or whatever. But rheology is hard because a lot of what we have comes from experiments. It comes from experiments on olivine. Dry olivine, and so we have stress-dependent laws and all sorts of good things for temperature-dependent viscosity. They're all on olivine, and they're all dry, or almost all of them are dry. That's not completely fair. But two, all the experiments have to be at strain rates that are far, far different than those on the Earth. Now, if you're Dave Colston, who's one of the greatest at this, or many others, you might believe that that's not a big deal. But rheology, just like other issues, they do go through something you could call a phase transition. You can change very dramatically from one regime of deformation to another. That means that if you are far away, seven orders of magnitude in strain rate, this might be a big deal. I raise this issue all the time, but, you know, well, until recently, until I got tenure, not too much, but, okay. Now, there's another issue here, and that is the equations, as you know, as we did the some approximations, which showed incompressible flow. I had written the equations are fully compressible. And the fact is that if you are going to include any pressure dependence, you do need the model to be fully compressible. Particularly if you're going to include phase transitions, although most models don't do this completely, you do need full compressibility to give you the right pressures. Most people do something that is called an extended Boussinesque so that they can get rid of that part. Okay, the energy sources, a lot of this is going to come from geochemistry, cosmochemistry, and then dynamo arguments, for example, and also chemical composition from geochemistry in a broad sense, and what I mean by that is also petrology. Okay. Difficulties. Well, I've mentioned the rheologies, and I'll mention the other thing is that all the rheological laws that we've measured, every single one of them, are essentially useless at making real plates, and you'll see that tomorrow. And you have to come up with rheological laws that are very different and that take into account other processes. Okay, so making plates is difficult. Asymmetric subduction is very difficult. Most of what you get, because of the way fluid dynamic works, is something that looks like an inverted plume. You get two-sided subduction, and that's not what it is like in the Earth. Now the other problem, and again this is for people that worry about stuff like this like me, lithosphere and mantle are very hard to treat together. These are very different timescales of deformation, and therefore the numerical methods that are best suited for doing lithospheric deformation and for treating elastic deformation, viscoelastic deformation, all Lagrangian. But you cannot use Lagrangian methods because they will distort the grid enormously over the time scales of the age of the Earth. So most mantle convection codes, as well they should, are Eulerian. That means that treating the mantle together with the lithosphere is very difficult. The lithosphere together with the mantle is very difficult. But there is progress, and this is probably one of the best numerical people today, and that's Louis Morezi, who wrote SICCOM. And this is right here, and this is spreading in the lithosphere, and it's actually driven by some mantle flow as well. And it was a little movie, and I'm going to try to run it again. Go back. Come on, you should be able to do this very quickly, and it doesn't do it. Okay, yeah, there you go. The neat thing about this method is a combination of finite elements that was something that is called particle in a cell, and what it does is it tracks the material properties. So you still have finite elements, you can still have your Eulerian grid for mantle flow, but you get all the deformation and all the history of deformation for this particle in cell method. Okay, then this I alluded to earlier, full thermodynamics, phase transitions, including melting, right, which is a phase transition, so that you are able to, this will be important, believe it or not, this is very important for making plates, if you do, or, and doing isotopic heterogeneity or any geochemical heterogeneity. But if you do melting properly, extracting melt dries things out, it increases the viscosity and it makes the plate stronger. And it makes what stays behind, it makes it weaker, and therefore it makes an asthenosphere. And this turns out, and this is on the findings of Paul Tuckley, that it's very important for making plates that behave properly. The other thing that in the context of this workshop is very important is treating geochemical heterogeneity and mixing. Okay, now I don't work in this field, but I'll make some sweeping statements. The methods for treating mixing are very old in a sense. I mean, there's stuff that, you know, Mackenzie was doing in 1984. These are tracers, either passive or sometimes active tracers. Okay, so there are none of the methods that, say, people use in atmospheric sciences. I realize that the concentration gradients are very different and so on, but there hasn't been a lot of numerical innovation at that end. Now, even within just the tracers, depending on what you use for the tracers and what kinds of filters you put, if you have a very sharp chemical interface, the results on how much entrainment you get are substantially different. Okay? And so this is a problem that has to be treated and one that people do worry about. And then you'll see that then it's important to do laboratory experiments so that you can benchmark the numerical calculations. And then characterizing mixing, how do you really characterize whether something is well mixed or not is another important issue. Okay. Some recent work, I'll go through this quickly because I think this is taking longer than I expected. Okay, so some mantle circulation model. This is an idea that actually has been advocated by Mark Richards and Peter Bunga, and that is to, you know, do three-dimensional spherical convection, impose the history of plate motion at least for the last 120 million years, and then run through and look at what the flow looks like and compare it to seismology. And so that's a mantle circulation model. And, you know, that's great, and there's lots of things you can investigate that with that. You know, scales of flow, do you suppress small length scales and so on? Can you actually reproduce some basic features of seismic tomography and so on? But there are also some unsatisfying things with this. This is not, you. First of all, none of the calculations are at the right parameter range, and you'll find that having things at different Rayleigh numbers makes a difference. The lower the Rayleigh number, the thicker your boundary layer. So if you're not at the right Rayleigh number, the boundary layer that you reproduce in those calculations tends to be thicker, means that it tends to drip and actually produce sort of Rayleigh terror-like instabilities. The other thing, that the buoyancy content is very different than that of the lithosphere, oceanic lithosphere in particular. So you impose plate motions that come, you know, from plates that have a certain thickness and have evolved from Earth in a certain way on models like this, and you actually have an incompatibility in terms of the buoyancy content of your lithosphere that goes down and the velocities that you have imposed. And this is an issue because it means that your subduction zones don't behave properly. Okay, in terms of geochemical heterogeneity, there's a lot of really nice work on plumes, both experimentally and theoretically. I showed just something here from Cinzia Fainatani. And in this particular case, she's just modeling one plume, but it has a dense layer at the base, and she's looking here at the advection of the tracers. And you see that there's a lot of very complex behavior, and there is material that maybe might never be sampled, but nonetheless might have been entrained from the stance layer at the base and a very complex thermal structure. And I'll show you more of this, some very recent models, which actually show that for realistic Earth cases and letting the plumes behave naturally, you get plumes without heads many times. And that you get filaments and not necessarily, you know, the sort of simple structure that we've imagined. The other very active area of research and very exciting, and this is the only model I know of that actually can produce a subduction zone dynamically as opposed to kinematically, and there is a lot of regional models for trying to understand flow in the mantle wedge and the chemical heterogeneity, the trace elements, and so on. But a lot of those models are kinematic, meaning that you impose the slab going down, you don't solve the full equations. These are models by Magali Billen, and actually what she's able to show without going into the details is by using a stress-dependent non-Newtonian viscosity, she can actually get the slabs to originate, to actually go down, and to not go down just vertically, but to actually have the variety of dip angles that you observe in the Earth. This is viscosity. Whoops. These are viscosities. So this would be high viscosity in the red, low viscosities in the blues. But I'm not sure I understand all of it because this blue. But it just what? But then this can't possibly be temperature. Now I think this is the. Yeah, I don't. I have better things from her that I'll show tomorrow. This was just an illustration because I like the dip angles in this one. Okay, now here's another area of a lot of active research, which is making plates, and I'll go through this more extensively tomorrow. But basically, we owe this entire area of investigation essentially to Dave Berkovici, who thinks that, you know, if we're to understand mantle convection and plate tectonics, we better be able to generate plates from a mantle that is convecting. And I think he's right. And so what he has shown is that he has tried many different rheologies and trying to come up with a rheology that will give you plate behavior. And I'll go through tomorrow what is plate behavior. And what he's taken here is a measure of plate behavior and deformation. So here he has a very simple model. This is called a sink and source model. So there's stuff rising here and sinking here. And on this panel, there's the horizontal velocity of the plate. On the middle panel, this is the radial vorticity as a measure of the toroidal field, as a measure of the deformation. And on the rightmost panel is a measure of the viscosity. At the top is a temperature-dependent viscosity. Actually, but I think it's a yield strength, I'm not sure. And at the bottom is actually a viscosity that it's related to the volatile content in the material. And what you see is that temperature-dependent viscosity, which is very common, does not give you plate behavior because you get a lot of diffuse deformation inside the plate, while instead what you want is something that looks essentially black in the middle and everything concentrated on the edges. And that a volatile, a viscosity that is mediated by the amount of volatiles does a lot better. And these are the calculations of Paul Tackley, which actually gets closest to the behavior of plates in many different characteristics. And one of them is that ridges and trenches actually have different characteristics and behave differently. And the other is that he's taken into account this melt viscosity reduction that I talked about, and he's able to generate a local asthenosphere, meaning that something that is laterally varying is not overall the under all the plates, and get very close to plate-like behavior. And this is viscosity on this panel, and these are iso surfaces of temperature. And these panels up here, actually, this is no melt viscosity reduction, and these are melt viscosity reduction. This is when he gets closest to the plate-like behavior. Okay. There's also a lot of work on trying to understand chemical heterogeneity. Again, this is from Paul Tackley and his postdoc, Cochier. This is coming out soon in PEPI. And what he's done here is that these are not three-dimensional models. These do not have plate motions in them. But what he's done is taken into account a little bit more of the petrology and therefore also the phase transitions going on by having the olivine system and also the garnet and pyroxene system as the phase transitions that are going on in the mantle. And then he's, I think he has some melting coming out in some places, and then he actually has tracers to advect the material to see where material is going and to calculate the helium-3, helium-4 ratio, which is this panel right here. So this is temperature, this is composition, this is helium-3, helium-4, and these are the reference cases. And these are, if the crust is dense at the core mantle boundary, basalt is dense, you get this ponding of this layer that is very dense, and well mixed distribution of material. And then if you get it buoyant at the core mantle boundary, then the behavior is very different, and you can get concentration of helium-3, helium-4 ratios right here. Now, this is an advance, but there are issues with it, and something that Bruce mentioned as well, which is what is the density of basalt or Hartzsprungite at the core mantle boundary? Or, you know, what happens to slabs as well as they go down? Oh, this is variations from basalt to printed a tide or something like that. Okay, now, the other way we have to do things is to do experimental work. And this was very fundamental at the beginning. In most of fluid dynamics, there's still very, very active areas of investigation. And in the earth sciences, it sort of waned a little bit. And it's now there's a lot more going on. Not for the dynamo, there's lots of experiments going on for the core as well. Now, because we can write down the equations, we might in principle hope that by solving them, we can infer all phenomena. In practice, this is not the case. So observations of fluid motion in the laboratory and nature are essential for understanding the motion of fluids. Now, Bruce also mentioned this, but the fact that you can non-dimensionalize equations and do scaling analysis, come up with something like the Rayleigh number and the Prandtl number, means that you do not need to make an earth to look at the structure of the flow. You can make a tank in the laboratory, use a fluid like corn syrup with a high Prandtl number, get to a high Rayleigh number, and the structures of the flow that you observe should be similar to those in the mantle. Okay. So for the earth, you know, where you actually have pressure-dependent properties and all sorts of other things, which we cannot do in the lab, why not do just numerics? Well, what I mentioned in terms of mixing and the tracers and so on, it means that benchmarking is really important, say, for the amount of entrainment, and laboratory gives you a reality check on that. Numerically, we can still now get, with the proper resolution, to the right parameter range of the earth, especially the Rayleigh number, you know, whatever that means for the Earth. We can do some large rheological variations and some very interesting non-Newtonian rheologies in the lab, which might be important for this lab. What I mentioned in terms of thermochemical convection and mixing, and perhaps we can observe new physical phenomena. Now, I am fond of calling numerical stuff numerical simulations as opposed to experiments, because I think of experiments as something physical where you might be able to observe new physics because it's not controlled precisely. But I'm in the minority, and soon I think I'll be a minority of one. Okay, plumes and entrainment. These are some recent laboratory experiments in a huge tank, 2 meters by 2 meters by, I don't know, almost a meter high. And this had a dense layer. This is polybutene oil, and on top is corn syrup. These are by Mark Jelinek and Michael Manga. And basically, what they were showing is that you can get this very thin convex, thin tendrils of material entrained. And the other thing that they were arguing for is, because they could look at the relative motion of the different plumes, is that you can actually let the hotspots would not move relative to each other if we had this dense layer. So that was a neat result that came out of laboratory experiments. Another really neat result, which is hard to do numerically, is to look at trench rollback. This is from Chris Kincaid and Russ Griffith. And here's the tank. And they have a slab right here. This is the slab mechanism that let them vary the dip, the trench rollback rate, and so on. And there are some very cool things that came out of here that have geochemical implications. One of them is that they can measure the heating on the plate. And depending on the rate of trench rollback, either the center of the plate heats or the edges of the plate heat. And the other thing that they get, that again, depending on the rate of trench rollback, they get flow. These are actually photographs, streak photographs of tracers. They get flow from behind the slab to the front of the slab, which, again, has implications for the trace element geochemistry there. Okay, now back to this slide. Suppose that we knew those constitutive relations. Suppose that we knew all the material properties. Suppose that we could solve these equations at will for the Earth. You still would not be getting to Earth history. And the initial conditions that we don't know and we will never know, and any contingency of Earth history is something that will be really hard to do from first principles. Hence, we can take a different approach, trying to look at Earth history and observations of the Earth today. And that is to simplify the equations and say, okay, suppose we have a very simple rheology. Newtonian rheology, incompressible mantle. You can actually do this for more complex things. Then in that case, say, you don't solve the energy equation. You say you know the density heterogeneity. Remember that all the evolution is coming from the energy equation for us. And you say, well, I don't need to do that because I know the density heterogeneity. And the reason I know the density heterogeneity is because we have observations of what that might be. And this, of course, came in line with the tomographic models that Adam pioneered. And in 1985, I would say that this small revolution came into geodynamics when Brad Hager, together with Adam and Mark Richards and others, published a paper in which they took a tomographic model, solved these equations together to Poisson's equation for the gravitational potential, and predicted the Earth's geoid and topography. And so this is another approach to geodynamics and trying to understand specifics, trying to understand specific observations, the gravitational field, plate motions today, the history of plate motions, and so on. So I'm just going to give you a few examples. The power of this, let me just go back, is that these can be solved, this form can be solved analytically for a spherical shell. It's very fast. You can predict all sorts of nice things. Here's one prediction of the geoid from a model that is now based on tomography. That's not important. But what we know about the viscosity structure of the Earth comes from these type of analyses. A similar approximation, worrying about the time transients, is what you use in post-glacial rebound, and that's how we know the absolute viscosity of the Earth. And the viscosity structure we know both from inversions of post-glacial rebound and models of the geoid, such as those shown here by Forti and Mitrovica. And so whether you believe all the structure or not, the one thing that has come, has become very clear in the last 20 years is that the lower mantle is more highly viscous than the upper mantle. And that has important implications for convection. The other thing you can do is, and this is what I've done, is look at the plate motion history, and this is for a paper by Clint Conrad coming out soon. And I'm not, you know, going to go through the details. The basic idea is that we do very well because we have the history of subduction. But we find the variation in plate driving forces through time. The other thing you can look at is deformation, one as measured by anisotropy, and this is the work of Gaboret, Forti, and Montagnier, in which they do a model of mantle flow globally. They texture the material, they compute the texturing of the material, the history as it flows, and they look at the maximum strain, the axis of maximum finite strain, and compare that to anisotropy as measured seismically in the Pacific plate. And, you know, they do fairly well. So the idea is that flow in the mantle, simple flow in the mantle that includes plate motions, can also reproduce observations like this. Or, and this is my last slide, you can actually look also at the influence that flow in the mantle, both in terms of the radial stresses that it produces and the horizontal stresses, what contribution that has to the deformation of the lithosphere. And the answer is that although the answer is complicated, there is an influence from the mantle. I'm not showing you the observations here, but this region here, the blues mean compression, the red mean extension, and the green mean strike slip. And this area right here in the southwest, southeast Asia and the western Pacific, this is reproduced on the observation. This is due to the radial stresses or dynamic topography from long-lived subduction, and is the only way to reproduce the observation is to have that mantle contribution. So I hope I've given you a flavor of the things that we can do, and then we'll look in more detail at plates and plumes tomorrow and the day after. Okay. Questions? Yes, Marilyn. It's a tracer that it's not neutrally buoyant in the mantle, that has some density associated with it. So perhaps if you want to model a layer that has higher density, you put an active tracers in it, or one that evolves chemically in some way. And passive that's supposed to be neutrally buoyant with the flow. Turns out that there are two techniques. One is just to have the tracers and tracer counting. The other is to take the ratio absolute method, it's called. The other is called the ratio method. And they give fairly different results for entrainment, even for the same flow. Go ahead.
It's been a long time since I played this game. In the flow modeling, you model the GI.
Mm-hmm.
Then always used to be the problem is the
Yeah.
And nobody ever managed to predict more than 50% of that. All the rest of it was fine, and you could get a random reduction of 85% of this one term.
Yeah, you know, that really hasn't gone away, not for seismic models. That's still true that the C20 is underpredicted by seismic models. And that is, of course, the biggest term in the geo.
So, medicine?
Well, no. I mean, you know, I mean, short of an ellipticity correction. I don't know. I think, actually, I'll take it back. I think one of Barbara's models does get it. Just get it, actually. I don't know if it does what you did there. This is what's up. SA 12D. Oh, I did drop the mic. SA 12D. But, well, it's possible that perhaps, you know, if you don't have, as good resolution in some parts of the lower mantle, that you're missing some degree two structure, or the power of the amplitude of the degree two structure. That the degree two structure is there, but that amplitude is.
No.
Okay. No. It's not enough.
It's called my modes, you know.
Yeah, okay. Okay. Well, I don't know then. I don't know. It is substantially underpredicted. You just don't get more than half, you know? Yeah, 70% variance reduction. Yeah, I just meant the degree 2, C2, 0. They just doesn't get much more than 50%, except for the SAW code.
When we are modeling, that
well, I did some work recently with a former student to look at every single tomographic model to invert for a viscosity structure. But I didn't plot the C2-0, so I can't answer you for the, I mean, there's now like 30, right? So I can't answer what the difference in the C2-0 are now. You can get pretty good variance reductions. I mean, the bottom line is that the viscosity, the geode is not that good a way to get a viscosity structure, that all you can constrain is that the lower mantle is more viscous. For the rest, you can allow a soft transition zone, a weak transition zone, you name it.
So what I'm doing is I'm